Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behindthebadge.
Deborah Solomon writes about budgetary matters for the New York Times, and she's on WGN Radio. Deborah, it's John Williams. Welcome to the show. How are you?
Good. Thanks for having me.
You're the economics editor at the New York Times, and the Times just recently had a description of the president's proposed budget, what gets cut and what gets boosted and what it means to you and me. Overall, what should I know about the budget?
Well, first of all, it's not a small budget. It's $4.8 trillion, which is a touch above last year's request. And that last part's important. It's just a request. So Congress can, and generally does, ignore the president's recommendations, particularly when it comes to cutting some of the domestic programs that he's routinely suggested slashing, like public radio and environmental protection programs. That said, this is an election year budget, and it highlights the president's spending priorities. And his priorities in this budget are more spending on things like the military, weapons, more money for border enforcement, including another $2 billion for the wall along the southern border, more money for infrastructure, and more money for helping veterans with things like suicide prevention and efforts to help with opioid addiction. And on the less spending side, and the types of things that people might be concerned about or curious about if they get public assistance, he's again proposing cuts to domestic programs, things like food stamps, housing assistance, disability payments, Medicaid, and some cuts to student loan programs.
Yeah. SNAP is in that list, too.
Yes. So over the past 2 years, the administration has been chipping away at the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, what we all think of as food stamps. And the budget does include about $15 billion worth of cuts for this year and about $180 billion over the 10-year period. And these cuts would come primarily by increasing work requirements and other requirements for people who get SNAP. So, for instance, the budget now calls for expanded and toughened work requirements. It doesn't matter anymore if you have children or not. They want people who qualify for food assistance to have to work or go to some type of training for at least 20 hours of work a week. And, you know, that a lot of people might say that's great. You know, people should be working, but unfortunately for some people who have child care issues or elder care issues are not able to. So you have some folks out in the, you know, advocacy world who are saying this is going to, put a big burden on families who rely on food assistance, to help supplement their nutrition budget.
But there are some exceptions to that, right? That is, if you have children, it seems to me we've looked at that in Illinois here a little bit, and that it's not a carte blanche. There are some people who will still be able to get food assistance if they have other people depending on them, no?
Well, again, I mean, this is just a proposal, but the change in this budget is that it would no longer matter if you have children or not. So the budget proposes one set of work requirements for adults ages 18 to 65 who are able to work. That's to say they're not disabled or have some other reason why they can't work.
Yeah, yeah.
But it does not matter. It does not make a distinction whether those adults have children or not. All adults who are able to work would have to engage in at least 20 hours or more of work or training in order to qualify for benefits.
And while that might sound draconian or harsh, given how many jobs there are out there, maybe this is the time to sort of put the fire to some of these people and say, you know, why are we paying for your food? You can't, in this economy, you can get a job. Maybe that's, if ever we were going to do something like this, Deborah, I could see the administration arguing this is the time to do it.
Well, right. I mean, I think there are, you know, in the budget, you do see a lot of references both in this area and things like housing assistance, where they want to get people off of depending on the federal government. And they say, you know, 10 years after the recession, as we're in an 11-year expansion of the economy, people should be working. They should be less reliant on the government. That said, there are a lot of people who qualify for food assistance who are not, who are not just sitting home waiting for a check, as some people would like to depict. You know, these are working families who just don't make enough to get by, and this helps them supplement their food income. So those people may not be disqualified under this program. It's hard to know. This is just a proposal. There's no details surrounding it. But the administration has, on its own, changed some of the work requirements, and some states, I think Illinois may be one of them, are challenging those changes. But under the administration's own estimates, it would move about 700,000 people off of the food stamp rolls.
Are there a lot of working people who get food assistance or some of these programs?
Oh, yes. Yeah, definitely. definitely. I mean, housing assistance, you know, people who get housing assistance, low-income housing help, these are people who generally have jobs. You know, they just, as you probably know, I mean, I'm sure Chicago is not a cheap place to live. It's expensive to live, and it's expensive, you know, if you have to afford a car and you have to have health care and all these other things, child care. So a lot of people who work do get help from the federal government. And, you know, these, there are also cuts in the budget to health care, things like Medicaid and disability payments, things that people rely on the government to provide if they run into trouble, you know, or if they are, you know, hurt or injured. So, you know, this budget does have some pretty, you know, draconian cuts if you're looking at it just strictly from a number side. But there's always going to be nuance and, you know, do people deserve it or not? But the answer is when you look at the budget as a whole, it cuts about $2 trillion from safety net programs and student loan initiatives over the next 10 years.
What about student loans? I heard you mention that. I know there's a conversation with the likes of an Elizabeth Warren about just wiping all student debt out. What does this budget propose for student loans?
Right. Well, it's really interesting. I mean, given this is an election year budget, there is a very clear distinction between what the Democrats are proposing, which is more government assistance, and what this budget proposes, which is less on all sorts of things, but it's particularly on student loans. I mean, and this is not new. The administration has called for this before, but they call for eliminating subsidized federal loans, student loans, which is, you know, government-assisted federal student loans, and ending the public service loan forgiveness program, which is an incentive for teachers, police officers, government workers, and other public servants. It cancels their remaining federal student loans after a decade of payments, and the, you know, the administration has proposed cutting that. It was in last year's budget, but Congress did not pass it. And it also changes some of the the calculation for what you have to pay. So right now, there's about a some of these plans for repayments require you to pay about 10% of your discretionary income
right.
towards your student loan.
Right.
This proposal would have you pay more, about 12.5%.
I wonder if they'd grandfather the people in and leave them be under the old program, or if they changed it, would those new rules apply to the people who had previously sort of signed up, you know?
I don't know. It's a good question, but I would expect that it would be everyone who is still in that program.
Yeah. It's funny. I know a little bit about that. A regular guest here, an advertiser here, is always touting the fact that if you make a decade's worth of payments, 120 consecutive payments, and you're working in the public sector and you had a federally backed loan, that you get loan forgiveness at the end of that 10 years. And if you manage that, it means many tens of thousands of dollars of loan forgiveness. And that's a godsend for some people. And a lot of us scratch our heads and wonder why we allowed that anyway. It's great for them, but if you have a loan, shouldn't you pay off the loan? I guess that's the give and take of that.
I mean, you know, there is a give and take there, and I think that a lot of people who are who want to go into public service, this is a way to incentivize them. I mean, you know, being a teacher, my parents were both public school teachers, you don't make a lot of money. Police officers, you don't make a lot of money. You go into these jobs because you want to, you know, you believe in the mission, and so the government is trying to help people, incentivize them to do this, to take on student debt so that you can get the training, but then the government helps you after 10 years if you've actually made your payment. So that's the one side. The other side is, you know, if you forgive these student loans, yes, it is taxpayer dollars that are going towards that, but it also helps boost the economy, because if everybody's drowning in debt, they're not spending money on the things that drive this economy anyway. So that's the other side of it, you know, that if you actually help forgive some of these student loans, it will help everybody because, you know, people will have more disposable income. They'll be buying more stuff, which helps lift the gross domestic product and eventually helps lift wages for everyone.
Yeah, how about that? Well, that sort of economics applies to the rich people. Why can't it apply to everybody, at least in theory? These are some of the cuts, but now I'm interested in some of the spending. Let's take a quick break and tell me about the border wall, about military, about the veterans, stuff like that. In just a minute, we're visiting with the economics editor of the New York Times, Deborah Solomon. This is WGN. We're visiting just for a couple more minutes with the economics editor of the New York Times. Deborah Solomon writes about the budget, about federal spending, and she just got done telling us about cuts to various programs. Maybe this is a good idea, maybe it's not. If nothing else, it's sort of sort of look at who this administration is, who this president is. These are Republicans. They're never been big on social spending, so a lot of cuts to domestic programs. And then if you guessed what would Donald Trump want to be spending money on, it would be the wall, it would be the military, it would be the veterans. And that's where a lot of the money is more money is going, Deborah. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct. So he's asking for another $2 billion for the border wall.
And where does that money come from? I've heard that there's been a little bit of a shell game on that, that it's not new money, it's money from other programs. Do they have the right to take that from other programs, or is this just brand new spending, new dollars?
Well, just to remember, last year he asked for $5 billion, so it's less than that. But that $5 billion request resulted in a five-week government shutdown, which people may remember. He couldn't get into the national parks and all that fun stuff. Since then, he's been shifting funds that Congress allocated for military construction budgets to pay for the new border wall. Congress previously agreed to provide about $1.37 billion for wall construction, which was far less than the $18 billion Mr. Trump asked for in 2018. Last year, after he declared a state of emergency, after Congress did not yield to that $5 billion request, the Trump administration diverted money from military construction funds and other money intended for cracking down on illegal drugs. So it's going to use about $7.2 billion from that bucket this year, and now it's asking. Mr. Trump is asking for another $2 billion for about another 82 miles worth of the wall.
Yeah, that's a small amount of money, isn't it? I mean, it sounds like a lot, but you said it's a $4.8 trillion budget. So,
right.
1.37 or $5 billion is the only reason we're arguing about that. I'll bet is just the principle of the thing, right?
Right. And I mean, and in addition to the border wall funding, he's also asking Congress for about $15.6 billion more for customs and border protection, which is about a 7% increase, and a 23% increase for ICE. So this budget does devote significant resources to preventing illegal immigration, as he likes to call it. So that is, you know, that is one of his priorities, and it is going to set up another clash with Congress. As I said, they don't have to pass this budget. They won't pass it in full, but even when they do their individual spending bills, the border wall and immigration enforcement is going to be an issue again for the Democrats who control the House. So we've got money for that in there. He also has some more money for new types of weaponry. These are sort of these hypersonic missiles. Russia has already developed them. China has expressed interest in developing them. The United States has been somewhat farther behind. These are very fast missiles that can evade detection. And so he's asked for a pretty significant increase, about $3.2 billion for these weapons, a 23% increase over last year's request, to help, you know, bulk up the American military, and more, more funding for nuclear efforts.
Will military members get an increase in pay as a result of this? I mean, I'd be interested in that.
Well, that's a separate issue, and he actually, for non-military civilian workers, you know, the career officials, he has recommended a 1% increase, which is less than they were slated to get, but more than they got last year when there was a freeze. For military, I don't know exactly what he's proposed, but that's going to be up to Congress. They decide. They're the ones who hold the purse strings. They will decide, and there generally is always an increase for military and retired military, people who have served the country.
Economics editor of the New York Times, Deborah Solomon's on a phone line. One last thing, Deborah, it just seems like nobody talks about this anymore, but do we have the money to pay for all of this? And since we have this huge debt anyway, I'd like to see a budget that said we're going to take a big old hunk of money and just pay down that credit card we have. Can you talk about that?
Sure. So, you know, it's interesting. There has been very little discussion of the deficit. The president's budget says that the deficit will fall below $1 trillion this year. Remember, it reached $1 trillion in 2019. The Congressional Budget Office, the Federal Reserve, and other independent economists say that we are going to be at $1 trillion deficits for the, you know, next several years. The Trump administration says that the budget deficit will continue to exist until 2035 when they see a surplus. Now, they get there through very rosy economic assumptions. They're assuming that the economy will continue to grow at about 3% every year, and they're assuming that interest rates will stay, you know, low. They are very low right now, and that so that we will have, you know, fewer payments or less payments on our debt. That, according to most independent economists, is unrealistic, considering we have huge outlays in our future for baby boomers who are retiring, and we're spending a lot of money. We're spending more than we're taking in. And the interesting thing is the one area where Republicans, I mean, most people, you know, the Democrats panned this budget, said it's a non-starter, unrealistic, punch to the middle class. The Republicans weren't even that excited about it. And the one thing that they did seize on was the deficit and said that it was not a fiscally responsible budget.
2035 is the best you can do for me? You mean even if all goes well in 15 years, we won't be running a deficit? I'd like to stop running a deficit next year and just spend less money on stuff. I don't know if that's possible, but wow.
Well, yeah. I mean, deficits aren't necessarily bad. It just depends on what you're spending the money on. You know, selling debt is it's okay. I mean, it's fine. That's the way economies work. But if it's unsustainable, meaning that eventually you are going to run out of people to provide money for you to spend, you know, to pay your bills, that's a problem. And the Federal Reserve has started warning that they think we're on a pretty unsustainable path because we have all of these huge, you know, payments coming due in the next few years as more people retire and as fewer people get into the labor force.
Well, that's
so it is a real issue.
Yeah. And, it, you know, whatever you say about this, however good or bad, however alarming or encouraging people see things in here, like hooray for the border wall or oh no for SNAP, it doesn't happen without both houses of Congress passing it, right?
Correct. Yeah. And I mean, if you're going to, you know, pass big tax cuts and increase government spending, you're going to have a deficit.
Hold on, I'm writing that down. That, I mean, it's so simple. And I'm intrigued, though, by what you said. You're not the first person to say it. Deficits aren't necessarily a bad thing. That's how small businesses operate. Anybody that's borrowed a lot of money to grow their business knows if they can pay the note that that's the way it goes. It's not a bad thing at all. But these numbers just get so gigantic, it seems terrifying. It seems like it has to be a bad idea at some point, you know?
Right, at some point. I mean, if you look at the trajectory of the United States workforce, it becomes pretty alarming further, you know, 20 years out, because we are an aging population, an aging demographic, and we're going to have more people who need retirement benefits, Medicare, all the sorts of safety net programs that you and I have been paying taxes towards and have been expecting to get once we retire. And we're going to have fewer people in the labor force who are going to be able to pay those bills. So at some point, there will be less money to go around, and you can hope that people will continue to want to buy the government's debt. But, you know, there's always a chance that if your liabilities are so huge that you will have to pay incredible amounts of money to attract investors to buy your securities, your debt. And that becomes, you know, fiscally unsustainable. Again, this is not for, you know, some time, but 20 years is not that far away.
And that's an argument for growing the population, right? Either through birth rates or immigration. If you want more people to pay into Social Security, and you do, you want more people right now paying in to fund the people on the other end, then you need to have more workers. You need to have more people, right?
Exactly. You need to have people have to have, start having babies, and immigration is actually really great for the economy. I mean, yes, there are immigrants who who use social services, but they also, a lot of them pay taxes and pay into the Social Security program and the Medicare program. So, yes, you can only grow your labor force through two ways, you know, more people coming to live here, more people being born here.
It's nice to talk to you, Deborah. If I want to follow you on Twitter, are you busy on social media? What's a good way to check you out?
It's a pretty nerdy Twitter feed, but yes, it's Deborah _ Solomon is my handle.
Well, that's not too bad. I can figure that out. Deborah Solomon is the economics editor at the New York Times. Thanks for your time this afternoon. Let's see, afternoon.
Thank
for,
you.
No, morning for you, too. It's 10:55 here. Thanks for your time.
Thank you. Have a good day.
You too. Deborah Solomon.